it was about a month or two ago that I was just flipping through my local paper and saw an article about dogs for diabetics, which seemed like a nice idea. But when I began to read, I found out that, in fact, these dogs really help and enhance the lives of diabetics. So, of course, I had to try to track you down. Carol, welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on the program today. Tell me about Dogs for Diabetics.
Dogs for Diabetics got its start back in 1998 when Mark Ruffinot was traveling with a guide dog and training puppy back in New York City. He had been sightseeing for the day and stopped and had a hot chocolate and a cookie for a little nighttime snack. And when he returned to his room for the night, he adjusted his insulin dosage to cover the sugar that he had taken in, but inadvertently went to bed without checking his blood sugar, which was a critical mistake in his case. He had not calculated the amount of the drop in his blood sugar due to the sightseeing that day, and he had a very dangerous low that night. During the night, he feels that he probably began to have a seizure. He could tell that he was in a very deep sleep, and he could hear the dog barking and barking and barking and trying to rouse him, but he knew he had a problem and he couldn't bring himself to a conscious state. Eventually, the dog jumped up onto the bed and began to get very alarmed with him and barking, and he was finally able to rouse himself and call for help. At that point, when they checked him, he was down into his 30s. When he came home, he checked in with his physician here, who said that the dog actually saved his life that night, which began to get us talking. Here is this dog with no bond formed to him that saved his life. Why couldn't we train a dog to do that? So that started 5 years of research into all kinds of dog training methods and figuring out what our ideal dog would be, as well as what kind of training methods we would employ.
I'm missing a link here in the story, though. How did the dog know that his blood, I mean, he was having a seizure, that maybe
right.
there was some visible.
And they feel that the seizure activity may have caused concern to the dog, so he reacted the way he did. But historically, if you look through, there's lots of recorded cases of dogs doing this naturally, alerting their partner that they're going to have an impending seizure or low blood sugar or even heart attacks now, is what I've heard.
So how does the dog know that someone's blood sugar level has dropped?
They can actually smell the chemical changes that go on in the body prior to the blood sugar drop. When the brain registers that the body is having a problem with low blood sugar, it dumps a bunch of chemicals into the bloodstream to try to counteract that. Even though in diabetics it doesn't actually work, they're not able to do the job, the dog can smell that different chemical combination, and they alert their partner to it. These dogs are actually alerting 15 to 20 minutes before a glucometer will pick up the blood sugar drop. So they're getting it right at the very beginning of the drop. Sometimes diabetics will test and they'll still be at 100 saying, I'm not going low. What are you talking about? They retest in 15 minutes. They'll find out they had a significant drop. And the dogs let them know before they even feel it.
They don't. And how do they let them know?
They do. Each diabetic's a little bit different. They have an alert. With each diabetic, we talk to them during the interview process and find out what they want for an alert. Most of the people want some kind of a physical contact, either the dog to jump up on them, to nose bump them, something of that nature, so that the dog can do it anywhere, at home, in a restaurant, in a movie, and be unobtrusive, but yet let the diabetic know you're starting to drop, you need to take action so that you don't have a low blood sugar.
So, Carol, is this the sort of thing that happens once every 5 years or once a month? I mean,
most diabetics, when they come to us, they are on an insulin pump, which actually helps to regulate their insulin very, very closely. Those diabetics tend to cruise at a lower blood sugar level. The lower and tighter control you try to keep, it's more easy to slip into a low status. So they will generally have more lows than the diabetic that's not trying to keep such tight control and cruises at a higher level. So it's more likely that these diabetics are going to use the dogs more often. With the way these dogs are trained, even if you do not have a low occurrence within a week's time frame, you need to do training with the dog so the dog always realizes that the game is on. When Mark first got his dog, he was cruising at a very high level and would only go low once every couple of months, but he had to continue to train Armstrong weekly so that Armstrong would not lose the game.
And do these diabetics who have dogs, the dogs, I guess you call them dogs for diabetics, D for D.
D for D.
D for D dogs. They keep them with them at all times.
For the most part, the dog is with them 24/7 because you never know when a low blood sugar is going to occur. There's many, many things that'll throw blood sugar off. You can do the same exact activity every single day, eat the same food every single day, and something can throw your blood sugar off. So it's best that the dog is there 24/7. The dog works 24/7. Now, that doesn't mean that he's always awake, doesn't get to play or things like that. They still get to be a dog, but they have to come back and check in with their human often. During the night, the dog will wake up from a sound sleep and wake their human up to let them know that the blood sugar is dropping.
So the dog will actually smell the change in the body chemistry even through sleep?
Even through sleep. What we do, it's very similar to the response. I don't know if you're a coffee drinker. Do you enjoy coffee?
Decaf, but...
Okay, will that smell of coffee wake you out of a sound sleep?
It might.
Okay. It's very similar, or the other one I use is bacon. The smell of bacon does it for me. And the dogs...
And then you pant and your tail wags.
Pretty much. I get up looking for that bacon, okay? And it's pretty much the same thing the dogs do. They get a whiff of that. It goes to the part of their brain that makes them realize that there's going to be a reward associated with that. And that reward, these labs love to please and they want to work. We just make that reward the most exciting thing in the world so that they want to wake up out of that sound sleep and get whatever it is.
Are all the dogs labs?
For the majority of the dogs are labs. We've done a golden retriever. We've done a few. We've tried a French bulldog. We've tried a labradoodle. We've tried other breeds, and we're very open to trying other breeds. Because most of our dogs come from Guide Dogs for the Blind, they tend to be all labs.
So you get dogs that haven't quite made it in their regular
right.
program?
We get dogs that are career changed out of their regular program. It can be for a temperament issue or a health issue that doesn't preclude the dog from working for us, but doesn't allow him to be a guide. We've had several that have soft trachea, which means that their throat, if any pressure is put on their throat closes for a moment until the pressure is removed. They can't pull into harness. We don't have a harness on our dogs. Our dogs can work quite happily. We've had other dogs like this dog here, Arcadia, who is too sniffy. She'd rather be following a trail of some important scent. So what we'll do is we'll take it and make that scent the human low scent, and she'll have a new job. We've had another one that wouldn't walk through puddles, won't keep a straight line, and wants to go around puddles. It's not a problem for our people because they're sighted. So I mean, it can be things like that that they bounces them out of the guide dog program, but we love it. And we get a dog that's had 2 years of training, that's had early socialization, which is very critical to the success of a service dog. They've had excellent obedience. They have breeding behind them of over 60 years. We get a phenomenal dog.
How many dogs have you at this point put out into the world with diabetics?
We have 10 dogs that are currently working and assigned to diabetics. We have another 10 in training.
And how long does the training take, and what takes place?
The training takes about 9 months, and it's divided up into three phases. The very first phase is a scent discrimination phase, where we're actually teaching them this is a scent, and you get something for it. Very similar to bomb or narcotic work. You know, that scent is the reward, and then we just work it until that is the most exciting thing in their life. Then we go into a transition.
Wait, how do you give them the scent? I mean, can you bottle this scent now? Or
No, you can't buy it,
I can't imagine that you want to line up some diabetics and say, okay, now we're going to get you dangerously low. Okay, here.
No,
here's
we
your insulin.
Absolutely do not do that. What we do is many diabetics go low naturally that we actually have a whole, we have several diabetics that do nothing, that when they are low and they're still functioning, that they will collect a sample for us. We have a whole scientific 4-page procedure that they have to follow, so that's very exact that we get just the low scent.
How do you collect a scent?
When the chemicals are dropped into the body, they're into the bloodstream, so they circulate throughout the body. It comes out through your skin, just like when you eat garlic, it comes out through your skin, so does
the smell.
Is that
what the smell is?
Yeah. It also comes out on your breath because the blood circulates through your lungs. It's usually found on the breath before it's found on the skin.
So you actually have them breathing into something?
Actually, we have them take it off their skin because it comes out through the skin. And it doesn't have to be in sweat. Like I said, there's a whole procedure that we've developed that works quite well.
Amazing. So mm-hmm. then you have these little like strips and
right,
dogs smell
right.
them.
And we actually teach them that this is the correct one and none of the rest of these matter. And we work up through them just being what we call blanks all the way up through, you know, high value food and other things that are very interesting to the sense of a smell of a dog. And then once we have proven that they know the scent discrimination beyond a doubt, then we move them into a transitional simulation phase where we then begin to say, okay, it's not scent training anymore. Now you have to look for it on the human and out in public and all those places. and you have to wake up in the middle of the night, and we work on all that. The very last phase is where they go into the home and they work with the diabetic, and they learn that they are only working for this one person. The one thing we found is that the scent is the same between every diabetic.
Fascinating.
From children to the elderly, male, female, it's the same across the board.
So you could, for instance, be walking down the street with your D4D dog,
and
there's someone sitting on a park bench, and he could go jump on her.
It's happened. It's happened several times. Airports are famous for it. You're walking through a crowd, and you're going this way, and all of a sudden your dog does a 180 and starts the other way because it caught a whiff of somebody in a crowd, and it wants to get that reward. What we do is once they're paired with an individual, we teach them to ignore everybody else. You don't get rewarded for that anymore. Now it's only the person you're with, the partner that you're with.
Amazing. Oops. Any great stories?
Oh, it seems with each placement that we make, at some time or another within the first few months, I will get that phone call that my dog woke me up. Or, you know, the last story I can think of that comes off the top of my head is we had a family of three in Santa Rosa where they have three kids under the age of 10 that are all type 1s. So it was a very special placement. We needed a dog that would pay attention to all three children equally and alert mom every single time there was a low. And it was very early in the placement, within the first couple of weeks, and they're doing what was called umbilical cording, where they're connected, physically connected to the dog to get the bond to grow. And one of the little girls had the dog, and she had just gotten into bed, and mom had just tested 15 minutes earlier, and she came up and said, "Mom, the dog's alerting on me." And the mother said, "The dog can't be alerting on you. You are 178, which is a very high number." But she tested it anyway, and the girl was still way up there, probably over 150. So she went back to bed, and Meadow, the dog, would not let up. She brought her back 15 minutes later, absolutely frantic. The girl had dropped down to 70. In that short time frame. And the mother said, "I don't know what I would have done. I would not have tested her for another 3 or 4 hours. She was so significantly high, she should not have crashed that quickly." And had Meadow not been persistent, and because she didn't get rewarded those first couple of times because it was a false positive. But Meadow didn't give up, and she continues to this day to drag the children to mom when they're low. So mom learned that, listen to the dog. The dog isn't wrong.
Very, very touching. How many people do you have working in the organization now? I would assume it's a mix of staff and volunteers.
Actually, at this point, we are an all-volunteer organization. We have nobody on staff. We do have probably 5 people that work full-time plus making this happen. And then we probably have another 40 people that come in various days of the week or nights of the week to make it happen. We have wonderful foster homes. None of our dogs are kenneled. They all live in homes with people. And these families bring them in 4 days a week for training. It's kind of like a doggy daycare. They bring them in, drop them off at 8 a.m. We train during the day, and they pick them up on their way home from work. That fifth day, they go to work or to school with them, and then they socialize them and take them out places over the weekend. So our dogs get that constant social working as well as the scent training while that's going on. We have wonderful diabetics that are very thankful for the dogs because we do not charge for them, that come back and say, "I want to give back to the organization. What can I do?" They write for grants. They help us with funding. Funding is always an issue for us. Being a small nonprofit and a startup, it's always a challenge. So we're always looking for ways to fund.
And hopefully we'll be able to help you out in that department by directing people to your website, which is dogs4diabetics.
Correct.
.org?
Actually, .com, but any of them will get you to us. We bought up all the domains when we did it, so they should redirect to it.
Okie dokie. And you are just in the San Francisco Bay Area at this point. I would imagine that there are people, the more they hear about you, that there people will be clamoring for chapters or to be served in other parts of the world, never mind the country.
Right. Currently, we're serving only Northern California because our follow-up service is so extensive. Once the dog is placed with a diabetic, we actually go into the home to train with them to make sure that that dog is working correctly. And that is several home visits over the first month. And then as time goes on, until that dog is working at near 100%. So we just don't have the funding to be able to reach out and do that in other areas of the country. We're hoping to expand into Southern California and eventually the West Coast and hopefully the nation and someday the world. But as funding allows, we do what we can.
You must get inquiries all the time.
We do. We get literally hundreds of emails a day. After something like this runs, we will literally get thousands of emails. And I have 2 or 3 volunteers that are very faithfully answering every single email. So if you do email us, be patient. A volunteer will get back to you.
It may take a while.
Right.
Maybe that's why you don't have a phone number on the website.
One of the problems with the phone number on the website is we were getting a lot of inquiries that didn't have to do with Dogs for Diabetics. We had people inquiring why, what to do with grandma because she has too much insulin, or how much insulin should I give grandma? And unfortunately, we just didn't have the staff to staff a phone and be able to answer that. But it is one of the things that you will see change in the next months, because we felt that there is definitely a need for it. We have to have a phone number now. And once it is there, we will publish it on the website.
Would you, do you think it's reasonable for others who hear about your organization to want to create a similar organization or a satellite branch of it in other parts of the country or the world?
One of the things that we have found with this in trying to get insurance to do what we do, the liability factor for this is very high. The consequences if our dog doesn't do its job properly can be very dramatic. So therefore, the liability is very high. Even though technically we say our dog is a secondary alert method, you should still follow every management technique you've always followed. We feel the possibility will arise that if someone should die someday, that they'll feel that somehow it was the dog's fault and we'll end up with a lawsuit. So there's not a lot of other schools that are willing to take on the liability for that. And it's one of the reasons we don't offer training advice to other people. If we tell you how to train your dog and you go train the dog and the dog fails to perform because we provided that advice, we are therefore liable.
Makes total sense.
Right.
So equally good for children, for elderly people, men, women?
Children tend to have a harder time with diabetes. Their drops tend to be more dramatic and faster simply because they don't have the body mass to be able to sustain it. So children tend to suffer from lows more severely. And that, so in that way, the dog could be more, have a greater effect in a child's life than anything else. Although we have a lot of diabetics are going off to college for the first time, out of the nest, handling the disease on their own, where the dog can be very effective in that college setting when you tend to let down your guard a little bit, maybe not eat as good as you should, and you need that dog as a backup system. So, and we find, you know, other adults like Mark, the founder, that travels so much, the dog is almost a necessity for him to be there when, you know, if he doesn't get his meal on time and the insulin isn't right, or something goes astray as it did in New York City. So it's...
Do you only place dogs with people who have type 1 diabetes?
Actually, we're going away from the type 1 so much as calling it insulin dependent. There are some type 2s that are more severe that are actually insulin dependent, and they can suffer for lows. What we actually look at is we look at your whole health history and see how severe your lows are, how frequent they are, and figure out if a dog can be of assistance to you. That's what we look at.
But you must have to turn away a lot of people.
We do. For every dog we have in our program, we probably get 100 preliminary applications off the website. From that, we boil it down to a lot of its geography, if they're in Northern California. And then we probably send out 10 long applications, which are about 18 pages long. A lot of health history, a lot of lifestyle history, a lot of dog handling history, so that we can get a really good overview of the family and the lifestyle, so we can get an idea of what kind of a dog would fit. From that, from those 10, there's probably one dog placed out of that 10. So we have 10 long applications and 100 short applications for every dog that we have in our program. It's just the demand at far exceeds what we're going to be able to cover.
Must be very rewarding work for you.
It's wonderful. Like I said, you get that call from that mother that says, I wouldn't have checked my child for 4 hours, and to think of what the outcome of that would have been.
It's quite amazing. Do the dogs wear little coats so that everyone out in the world knows that they are necessary and a working dog?
Yes, they actually have a blue coat on that says service dog with the medical emblem on it to let everybody know that they're a medical alert dog. It also has a patch across the shoulders that identifies them as a Dogs for Diabetics dog.
And they can go everywhere.
They can go everywhere. They have the same rights under the ADA law as a guide dog.
But this was brand new, right? There were never dogs for diabetics before. So.
No. There's no other school that we know that are training them the way we train them and placing them. It's unique in that way.
Once again, to learn more, I want to direct you to the website. It's dogs4diabetics.com.
Correct.
Carol Edwards, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
For Good Dog, I'm Joanne Green.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.